This is case number 66937, Ricky Hill v. State. We have Mr. Orem for the appellant, Ms. Lucich for the respondent. I expect excellent argument on both sides here.
Okay. You want to save some time, reserve some time?
Yes, Your Honor. Could I have 5 minutes, please?
Sure.
May I proceed? Mr. Hill is entitled to a new trial based upon ineffective assistance of counsel. There are several issues that were raised in this case that are disturbing. I'll start with the first argument, well, actually it's argument number two, but that really encompasses what starts in opening argument and continues into closing argument, and it is disturbing for a number of reasons, and you can see from my quote that it is the very start of opening argument. Counsel says, "Ladies and gentlemen, I noticed when the clerk was reading the information, some of you may have gasped. Some of you may have looked away when some of these things were read. Mr. Hill needs you to understand he is being with both men and women in his life. If you don't like him now, you're probably not really, really not going to like him at the end of this trial. I don't condone that lifestyle. I'm married. I have 3 kids. In closing argument, he starts, "If you remember at the beginning, I told you that you probably are going to, at the very least, dislike the defendant. And that quite possibly by the end of this period of time, that you will all probably hate the defendant. I think what he did is repulsive. I think being a homosexual and bisexual, I do not condone that. I don't think it's appropriate lifestyle." Later in closing, "And as best as you can, you have to get that out of your mind, even if that's the most repulsive thing you, just to think about a homosexual, or you heard discussion about lesbian." What is curious about that? Is that Mr. Hill has testified that he had consensual sex with a 16-year-old who, by the way, had a girlfriend who was pregnant at the time. So during the evidentiary hearing post-conviction, I asked counsel, why did he refer to the act of homosexuality? What did he mean? It was repulsive. And his answer to me, which I cited in the briefs, was, well, what's repulsive about it is he was having sex with a minor. So then I point out, no, he wasn't having sex with a minor. This is a boy, age of consent. And so then he said, well, it was strategic. The state has latched on to that. See, it was a strategy. I looked at it, well, wait a second. That's not what he first said. He said he had sex with a child, which he didn't even seem to know his own case to say that. But what is really disturbing is, in this day and age, to have an individual who is on trial saying, okay, I had a homosexual relationship, and it was consensual, to have the defense attorney, instead of in voir dire, because if I could move backwards for a second, I think the question is not whether I've shown, was this below a standard of reasonableness? Of course it was. What's the prejudice? The prejudice is obvious. During voir dire, what this defense attorney should have been doing was investigating whether prospective jurors had any difficulty with the concept that they were going to hear about homosexuality in this trial. And if they did, imagine if a prospective juror made these type of statements that we heard in opening and closing. Why would defense counsel then not challenge for cause, or at least start to bring out in front of the jury that there is nothing wrong with homosexuality? Nothing at all. There is absolutely nothing. And as a defense attorney, isn't that what we're supposed to be doing? Are we really supposed to be doing the job? And I don't think this was the prosecutor's job, because this is the prosecutor who argued the case, and I know she would never say anything like that. Absolutely never. She never adopted this.
Mr. Orem, I understand the argument, because it is kind of an unusual strategy, if that's what it was, but Judge Silver handled the post-conviction proceeding, and she has 12 pages of findings of fact, conclusions of law. We have to give deference to at least the findings of fact. Tell us what you think the error is on what she did in the post-conviction proceedings.
Because I don't think it was a strategy at all. I think what this really was, I think when you break it down, and that's where the error comes in the district court judge's ruling, is this wasn't strategy. When I asked him the question at first, he didn't say strategy. He used that because he got caught saying that it was with a minor. Second of all, I really think that really what this was he was embarrassed. He was embarrassed of the concept of homosexuality. It seems obvious that he didn't really want to address this. It was embarrassing. Because he even points out, I got a wife and 3 kids. What's the relevance? And that's the difficulty with what the court did. And I also think that the court looked at, where's the prejudice? The prejudice is you have a defense attorney who almost looks like he wants to go sit by the prosecutor. Like, that guy is, look at that behavior. Say, I don't condone that. Hearing about homosexuality? It was just something that would jump out at the page at the reader. And I imagine, since I'm in front of three former district court judges, that it should jump out in a trial. What are you saying? You don't make arguments to that. And that therein lies the argument. There isn't much more. The Ninth Circuit, as I pointed out, has condoned this. Back in 1967, this court, in a case of Walker, determined that this court frowned upon a prosecutor questioning a witness about homosexuality when there was no relevance to it. And the reason I point that out is because defense counsel at the evidentiary hearing said, well, this was 2005. It was a different era. And I thought, no, it's not 1905. And in 1967, this court frowned upon it. So I have numerous other arguments, but I thought that was glaring. The next argument I would like to go to is the fact that defense counsel filed a motion for an independent psych exam of the jury. And I suppose I should say his initials, but I'll use his first name, Jeremy. It was denied. Not only was the psych denied, but I'd like to point out also that the district court judge denied counsel an investigator as well, which seemed very curious. Why would you deny an investigator? But as I look at this, you have to dovetail this issue with the issue of Nurse Ebert, who was permitted to say, now, this young man came in the next day for a sexual assault exam, no findings, nothing, absolutely nothing. The nurse testifies, well, I've examined 2,500 sexual assault victims, and this boy's demeanor is consistent with a victim of sexual assault. So I wonder, why is the defense being denied an independent psychic evaluation of this particular individual? And since the state was permitted to introduce that evidence from Nurse Ebert, and there's no corroboration, surely under Abbott and Kirshner, they were entitled to it. And what is even of more significance, and I apologize if what I'm about to say is in any way offensive, I don't mean it to. But what would be the reason someone would question the veracity of this young man? This young man said that while Mr. Hill was performing oral sex on him, he ejaculated. And this is where I think it is more difficult, but what I suppose as a male, we associate ejaculation with ecstasy, not terror. So it made me very curious how the state was able to explain it, and this prosecutor is a magician at explaining that type of evidence to a jury. But as a male, it makes no sense. And, okay, I'm not saying then that proves it didn't happen, that there wasn't, that he consented, but at least doesn't that give rise to the argument, if I was asking for an independent psychological exam, that isn't that something to question with this individual? There's no corroboration.
But aren't most of these issues would be for direct appeal, wouldn't they, primarily? Yes. I mean, I understand the ineffective assistance of counsel argument at this stage, but these others, is really something we need to really dig into on post-conviction?
Yes, because he asked for it. He asked for the independent psychological analysis and then does absolutely nothing on appeal with it. And what I've just argued to the court, I've met every standard of Abbott and Kirshner. I've met every standard. There's no reason to deny it. And you combine that with the failure to get an investigator, that it's refused. I see that I also want to mention this other issue. I've talked about Nurse Ebert. I think there should be that this court should reconsider or look at carefully letting these nurses consistently testify that the demeanor of the alleged victim is consistent with sexual assault. And what I did in my brief is I challenged the state. I said, show me a case, cite a case, where the nurse came in and said, no, state's victim is not consistent with sexual assault. They didn't take up my challenge. In fact, they mocked me, saying, well, we would never bring a case if there wasn't good evidence, sufficient evidence. I thought, you can't come up with a case because they're being permitted to do this over and over and over. And I do want to also address during cross-examination this discussion of Mr. Hill about his habitual offender status. Mr. Hill had unfortunately said he felt he was facing life without parole. The prosecution then seized on that and said, well, you can't face life without parole on sexual assault. He said, yes, I can. And an argument ensued where he was saying he believed he could. And then the district court judge allowed the state to question him about his habitual offender status. And the district court judge ruled that the door had been opened, and so now in front of the jury, we're going to let them file the habitual offender in front of the jury. As I look at the arguments I've made, there is multiple errors that occurred in this court, or in the trial court. With that, I'd ask for 5 minutes.
Sure. Ms. Lucas. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court.
Good morning, Justices. As Mr. Oram indicated, I am the attorney who tried the case in the lower court. And I do agree with this court that Judge Silver did find that Mr. Frizzell gave effective assistance of counsel, and her findings are entitled to deference. The defense cannot meet the burden of demonstrating that both Mr. Frizzell's representation fell below the objective standard of reasonableness, and that but for whatever deficiencies the court could find, which I suggest you can't, that the result of the trial would probably have been different. And I would also invite the court's attention to the order dismissing his direct appeal, or the order of affirmance, I should say, where this court indicated that abundant evidence in the record established Mr. Hill's guilt. Therefore, no matter what the court believes that Mr. Frizzell didn't do properly, the result would not have been any different because there was abundant evidence in the record. But that being said, to respond to Mr. Oren's comments, as far as Mr. Frizzell's comments to the jury about finding the homosexuality of the defendant to be repulsive and the things that he said, it was in fact a tactical decision, because as he sat there, and don't forget, when the court reads the clerk reads the information in the very beginning, we have the opportunity to look at the jurors, and he did see the jurors when they heard what he was being charged with and that the victim was a man, not a woman, make faces and gasp and things like that. So as he indicated, he was making a tactical decision to, or a strategic maneuver to try to defuse the situation, was how he described it, to what he thought was going to be an obvious bomb in the case, the defendant being with both men and women. This happened, the trial, in 2005. And I know Mr. Oram says, well, it wasn't 1905, but 2005 is entirely different in Clark County than 2016, especially the juries in 2005. They were remarkably conservative, much more conservative than they are now. So the fact that he made a strategic decision is something that was, in his mind, as a trial attorney, the right thing to do. He actually commented on how, while they were going through the trial, he felt like he was losing the jury, and that's why, in closing argument, he did it again, so he could get them back on his side. But additionally, at the evidentiary hearing, when Mr. Frizzell responded to Mr. Oram's question at first with that he was a minor, he actually is a minor. Jeremy was 16 years old at the time. And legally, while the age of consent could be 16, in society, a 16-year-old is still a minor. In society, the ladies and gentlemen of the jury view anybody under 18 as a minor. So when his knee-jerk reaction answer was, well, you know, he was charged with sexually assaulting someone who's young, he was charged with sexually assaulting someone who is young, 16. And Mr. Hill was significantly older than that.
How old was Mr. Hill at that time?
I want to say he was in his late 30s. I could be off by a few years, but I mean, they weren't close in age at all. Which brings me to the idea of the psychological evaluation. The defense kind of wants to have their cake and eat it too. They're calling Jeremy an adult for purposes of, well, you know, having sex with him is okay because he's above the age of consent. But this court's decisions about allowing a psychological evaluation of sexual assault victims really pertains to children. There are no cases wherein this court had said an adult victim of sexual assault should be subject to a psychological evaluation. And it goes back to the reason behind you have decided that the psychological evaluation of children was appropriate because, you know, children can make things up and there, you know, no corroboration and things like that. But it's all geared towards children. You don't want to put somebody in prison for 35 to life because a child said they did something wrong, unless there's something else, which is why you've allowed psychological evaluations to see if there is anything in the child's, you know, background or history or something that causes him to be unable to be truthful. Jeremy, at 16, the defense wants him to be an adult for purposes of one argument, but child for the purposes of the other argument.
But he was a minor, though. I mean, Mr. Arm does have a point. I mean, he was under 18, even though, regardless of the age of consent.
I think the term word is emancipated minor.
Okay. But didn't the district court possibly err by not, out of an abundance of caution, allowing a psychological exam?
There was absolutely no reason to allow a psychological examination of Jeremy. One of the things that you look at, you know, did the state call an expert? No, the state was not calling an expert. Two, was the testimony or the testimony of Jeremy corroborated? And literally everything that Jeremy said was corroborated because the defendant agreed that it happened. Usually the issue is not, was it consent or not consent? Usually the issue in the cases wherein you have agreed that a psychological evaluation is appropriate is when the defendant says it never happened. Why would a child make up that this happened if it never happened? So everything was corroborated except for the fact that Jeremy said no and the defendant didn't agree with that. So there was abundant corroboration. Also, the final thing to look to see if there was a compelling need back then under that system, case law, was whether or not there was something within Jeremy, like a reason that he would have made this up. And there was nothing wrong with Jeremy's emotional or mental state to demonstrate that there was a need for a psychological evaluation. So none of the factors under Romano, Abbott, or whatever cases were applicable at the time were met. There was not one thing that would enable the court to grant a psychological evaluation. That's why the evaluation was properly denied. And as far as Linda Ebert, the sexual assault nurse, being able to testify that his behavior was consistent with a victim of sexual assault, there's a statute that specifically says that she can do that. 50.345 specifically says expert testimony is not inadmissible to show that the victim's behavior or physical condition is consistent with the behavior or mental or physical condition of a victim of sexual assault. And Mr. Oren challenges us, you know, to show a case where they say it's inconsistent. Well, if their behavior was inconsistent, we wouldn't go to trial. That's a case that would either get dismissed or resolved or something else. And just for the record, we don't always ask that question because sometimes a nurse doesn't have an opinion one way or another. I'm in trial right now on a sexual assault case, and I'm not asking that question. I don't feel I need the information, but we don't always ask that question. When we ask the question, the nurse testifies that it was consistent with, because we've asked the question in pretrial, and we know that's what the answer is going to be. The fact that a nurse is permitted to testify that the behavior or the emotional condition is consistent with the behavior of the victim in no way gives any rise to allowing a psychological evaluation. They're two different things. It's just behavior consistent. The nurse never goes on to say, therefore, I think the victim was sexually assaulted.
Do you think the nurse testimony is a non-issue that Mr. Orms raised? It's really a non-issue. On post-conviction relief, at least, at this point. What about the habitual criminal issue that he raised?
The defendant brought that up himself. The defendant was arguing with me. Well, let me go back a minute. The courts have indicated that a jury is not supposed to know what the penalty is. The penalty for sexual assault is 10 to life, or back then it could have been 10 to 25. The defendant got on the stand and said, you're trying to give me life without for this sexual assault based on a lie of the kid. And I said, no, sexual assault is not punishable by life without. And he argued with me, and he was trying to tell the jury that simply because he put his penis in the mouth of a 16-year-old, and the 16-year-old didn't want it, he's going to get life without the possibility of parole. And my fear is that if a jury thinks that that's true, just because he put his penis in the mouth of an other person who didn't want it, he was going to get life without the possibility of parole, they would never find him guilty. And I think that he invited me to share with them that, no, the reason that he is facing life without the possibility of parole is his own fault. It's his own criminal record, that sexual assault is actually punishable by 10 to life or 10 to 25. And he wouldn't agree with that. He argued with me, no, it's not punishable by just 10 to life. It's punishable by life without the possibility of parole. And that's why Judge Mosley allowed me, and I didn't file the habitual criminal allegation in court, I simply moved it into evidence. There's a difference between filing and moving it into evidence, but that's what Judge Mosley ruled, and he ruled it appropriately. And just as far as the, and I'm sorry to go backwards, the argument that Mr. Frizzell should have explored the homosexuality in voir dire, I assume not many of you have tried a case in front of Judge Mosley, but in front of Judge Mosley, you are not allowed to ask anything that you want on voir dire. You have to submit your questions to him, and he says you can and can't ask this, and literally the only thing he lets us ask about is follow-ups to his. So if Judge Mosley says you're not allowed to ask about homosexuality in voir dire, you're not allowed to ask about homosexuality in voir dire in Judge Mosley's courtroom. So it's not something that could have been explored that way. But
what did Mr. Hill challenge in his direct appeal, Judge Mosley limiting the voir dire questions? Was that an issue?
It was not an issue.
That wasn't raised.
No,
there wasn't objected to a raise in direct appeal. Then.
No. Okay, this is flashing in strange ways. I can't tell whether I have time left.
We've got about 3.5 minutes left.
But as far as the cross-examination of Mr. Hill and the habitual status of Mr. Hill, it's all because of things that he did and he said that I responded to. I never offered any of his priors, any of the habitual status. I didn't cross-examine him on anything until he brought it up first. Unless the court has any questions.
Just clarify the habitual criminal thing. What did you actually do that Mr. Rowan is saying that you brought up a habitual criminal in front of the jury?
Tell me exactly
what happened.
The defendant said that he was facing life without the possibility of parole because a kid lied on him, is basically what he said. And my argument, because sexual assault is punishable by life without, and I responded to him by saying, well, sexual assault is not punishable by life without the possibility of parole. Sexual assault is punishable by 10 to life. And he argued with me saying, no, that's not the case, that sexual assault is punishable by life without the parole. And I brought up the fact, no, aren't you facing life without the possibility of parole because of your own prior criminal history? And when he argued with me continually still about that, I didn't just do it. We approached the bench first, and I indicated to the court that I wanted to move the habitual criminal allegation, the piece of paper that says you are now facing the habitual criminal allegation because of your priors. And it says in there that it's punishable by life with the possibility of parole or life without the possibility of parole, and I moved that into evidence. That had already been filed prior to the trial.
Now, was all that raised? Was that issue raised on appeal?
No, that was not raised on appeal. Because Mr. Frizzell, and at the hearing, Mr. Frizzell indicated that because he thought that it was appropriate that the defendant had invited me to do that, that he had opened the door, that he believed that it was futile to raise it on appeal. And that's what he said at the evidentiary hearing, that there were several issues that he believed were futile to be raised on appeal, and therefore he didn't, because he does have the ethical obligation to only raise issues on appeal that he thinks that he can prevail upon, not to raise issues that are frivolous. Mr. Frizzell gave him effective assistance of counsel, and I know you know this, that all of you have been trial attorneys, and just because you might not have done what Mr. Frizzell did, or you might not have said what Mr. Frizzell said, doesn't mean that it's reasonably ineffective. You just have to look back and see, was it reasonably effective what he did? And as you indicated in your order of affirmance, there was abundant evidence to convict the defendant. There wasn't much that Mr. Frizzell could do. He did what he could with what he had. And whatever he did, the result of the trial would not have been any different. And the state would ask the court.
Thank you, Justice. Oh. This is a question.
Mr. Orr mentioned an issue as to failure to allow an investigator as to the allowance to have a psychological exam, but the investigator issue. Was that brought up below in the habeas?
I don't think so. I don't know. The failure to appeal the psychological evaluation was brought up.
That was brought up. I don't remember.
I was
reading the order of the court as the habeas. I didn't see anything in there as to that. So I'm just asking because it was brought up and trying to.
But if the judge denies an investigator, there's really nothing Mr. Frizzell can do about that. So how could he be ineffective because Judge Mosley denied him an investigator? So the state would ask the court to affirm affirm the district court's denial of the writ because Mr. Hill did receive reasonably effective assistance of counsel.
Is Mr. Hill still in prison?
He is.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Orr, we have almost 5 minutes left.
I may move backwards, addressing issues. First, I'd like to talk about the habitual offender. I'm reading from the state's brief on page 39. This is not my brief. It's not my quote. This is how Mr. Hill was questioned about the habitual offender. He does start out by saying, I'm facing life without. He does exactly what the prosecution says. He thinks that life without is punishable. Sexual assault is punishable by life without. He's being corrected, and now on page 39, he says, I thought it carried life. I knew it was life or life without. Question, is there another reason that you think you're facing life without? No. I mean, if the jury believes the bold-faced lie this kid puts to me, I mean, question, your criminal record has nothing to do with the fact that you think you're facing life without. Is that what you're trying to say? Ma'am, does sexual assault carry a life sentence? Yes or no? That's the defendant saying. The question, does your criminal record make you eligible for habitual criminal treatment? Remember, I'm asking the question. Answer, yes, yes. Question, so because of your criminal record, that's why you're facing the sentence you're talking about, correct? Answer, sexual assault carries life. Question, the question is, does he know that he's facing life without it's because of his criminal record? Answer, no, I didn't know that.
When he was on the stand, when did it come out that he was an ex-felon? In other words, did the defense bring it out like the defense usually does, you know?
As I'm sitting here, I remember it came out. I don't recall whether it was on direct or cross, but it was appropriate within the rules of law.
That right.
The prosecution had a right to bring it out, and there was nothing wrong with that. But then the habitual offender comes in. But that is compounded within the court saying that I'm going to allow the prosecutor to explain the habitual criminal statute and how it works. This is to a jury. Wasn't it just easier to say, you know, you're wrong, sir. If a district court judge, you're wrong, that's not the statute. Anyway, you're not supposed to be considering punishment. Disregard it, and I admonish you not to talk about that any further. As to go into all this habitual offender nonsense. With regard to Nurse Ebert, she's now, they're being allowed to be human lie detectors. When the psych, if this is not appropriate on a post-conviction, should have been brought up on direct appeal. It still goes to the fact that we are allowing these nurses to be lie detectors. And I believe the prosecution today said that she's in trial right now, but I think she has tremendous findings, physical findings of the beating that this woman took that she's in trial with. Whereas here, these were a boy who went and did some landscaping with the defendant. They went into a parking lot, they had sex, he went and then he told his girlfriend, then he told his mother the next day when Mr. Hill called to say, hey, you want to work with me again? And that's when this came out. I hardly see that we should allow a nurse, 3 years later, to say that some 16-year-old came in, described sexual assault, no findings, not a scratch on him, and yes, That's consistent with sexual assault. Then why are we not allowing the defense an opportunity to have a psychological exam? Because would it have been unreasonable? Judges, justices consider jurors. If you heard somebody come and say, I'm the foremost expert on this, I'm from Harvard, I have all these credentials, and by the way, it's not consistent. Don't know how he could have ejaculated. It makes no sense. Would that be out of the realm of possibilities? Why was the defense not permitted to at least explore that avenue? The next one I wanted to comment on, so I would argue that that does constitute an expert. And then I wanted to cite to the court from this court's decision in Abbott, a person need not be a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist in order for their testimony to constitute that of an expert for purposes of Abbott or Kirshner. And so she does constitute an expert. There is no corroboration. And based upon the fact I've talked about, they were entitled to it. And there was no expert. I did raise it below, but I did it as it's raised below that there was no, excuse me, investigator. But I didn't do it as an independent issue. I just raised it, and I remember this morning, although I cannot find it right now, it's in my brief, it's cited to the Record on Appeal, where that is raised. As I look at all of these matters put together, I think that they should result in a new trial. I'll say lastly, in my last 10 seconds, Mr. Hill sent me a letter, if I could just finish this, and he said, please tell the court about the alleged victim's testimony, which could be found on pages 33 through 39 of the alleged victim's testimony. He said he thought that was compelling. I didn't have a chance to read that to the court. I'll just cite it to the court, and with that, I submit.
Thank you very much. The court thanks both of you for your excellent arguments and speech in this matter. I expected a good argument, and we got it. Congratulations to both of you. This case stands submitted. We're in recess until 2 o'clock.